In this hour at Focus 580, we will be talking with filmmaker Charles Burnett, a man who has been called the nation's least known great filmmaker and also America's most gifted black director. He was born in Mississippi, and when he was young, his family moved to Los Angeles, and that's really where he did his growing up. He went to UCLA, where he studied film, made his first feature while he was there. Actually, it was his thesis from film school, a film called Killer of Sheep, which was released in 1977, about a man who works in a slaughterhouse, and about his family and his hopes for a better future for the family. That film was among the first films selected by the Library of Congress to go into the National Film Registry. He's perhaps best known for his film To Sleep with Anger, a film that was released in 1990 and starred Danny Glover. Some others include The Glass Shield, about a man who becomes the first black officer appointed to the L.A. Sheriff's Department, a movie made for television called Night John, adapted from a young adult novel about a young girl who's taught to read by an escaped slave. He also directed a television miniseries, The Wedding, which was produced by Oprah Winfrey's company, Harpo Films. He was involved with a series about the blues that aired on public television. And he's here to take part this week in some of the events honoring Dr. Martin Luther King here on this campus. And as a part of the King Week here on the campus, there will be a film festival. And two films of his will be shown. A film on Nat Turner, which will be shown this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Florida Avenue Residence Hall. And then tonight, his film Night John will be shown at the Beverly Art Cinema in Champaign. So those are two are free and open to the public. And if you're interested, you certainly should turn out. And here on the program this morning, if you have questions, comments, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure being here.
One of the things that I read about you is that when you first went to community college there in Los Angeles and studied electronics, and then the plan was, or at least your thought at one point was, you were going to go to college and then study engineering. Mm-hmm. So how did you end up in film school?
Interestingly, at LACC, which is really a great school, it was then. You know, I had taken electronics in high school, and that was the only thing I knew, basically. And then when I got to LACC, there were a lot of people from the industry who were coming back, you know, and taking refresher courses. And so you got to know these people, and they had these sort of strange personalities. And I couldn't see myself being one of those people at the end of 20 years and, you know, 30 years. And, you know, the only concern was waiting for retirement and trying to get a gold pin or gold watch and having a 6-week vacation. And I said, no, that's not for me. And then the other thing is, once you start specializing in electronics, it's not as exciting when the field was open, you know. And, and the only other jobs were like working for, you know, war industry, things that has to do with government contracts and things like that. So there's always layoffs and things like that. And so I said, no. And I was working downtown, so I had a lot of time to go to the movies. And I was I still have to use the cough button.
No,
sorry. And
<It's okay. laughs>
and I was going to the movies a lot, and I started taking a lot of creative writing classes, and when I was younger, I always wanted to do something in photography and still photography, but never had the opportunity, and so I started to make that transferring over into the visual arts, you know, I applied at USC, but it was too expensive to go to USC. And when I applied to UCLA, they said, sure. And it was really dirt cheap at the time, like $25 a quarter, which is...
We're never going to see those days
never
again.
Yeah. And so I went there.
Well, that's interesting that it sounds that your way in really was a strong interest in storytelling, which is really obvious if you look at the movies that you have made.
Well, strangely... they used to say that people from Mississippi are either liars or storytellers, you know. So, but no, I think it comes from my grandmother to some extent, because, you know, she was always telling the stories about Mississippi and so forth, you know, and I think it came from there.
Yeah. one of the things that I read you said about UCLA at that time, the film program there, was that people went there, they didn't go there expecting to make the jump from there to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. They went there with a different sort of agenda, a different sort mm-hmm. of idea about what it is that they wanted to do.
Well, UCLA was very special then. You know, it was right at the Civil Rights Movement, or during the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s. And UCLA was sort of anti-Hollywood, and it was very chaotic in a way. It was a great place to be because when you got there, it was very competitive. They only took like 10 students a quarter, mm-hmm. and you have to compete for that. And they gave you a camera and said, "Look, go out and make a movie, you know, and come back with something special, you know." And you had to be original. And it was at the end of the quarter, there was this period where you screen your films for, I mean, the faculty and the students. And it was a test of fire because, it was this criticism that was so heightened and critical. I mean, it would embarrass you almost at some of the comments. So you really had to, and that was the day you worried about. So you really made sure that what you were doing was going to be something special. Mm.
Were there people that couldn't take it? There were people at that first, maybe it was so strong, so vicious, they said, okay, I can't do this anymore. And at that point, left?
Mm-hmm. I mean, some students cried at the end of, you know. I mean, it's a really intense period. You, before the, you know, the screenings, you know, you may spend like 2 or 3 weeks working on your film, you know, editing it and so forth like that, you know, night and day. And so you're at that particular time unstable to begin with because, you know, all the effort and working night and day. And to get in front of an audience where everyone is just critical, you know. And they do it because it's something like a payback because they went through it. And so it's like, how vicious can you get, so to speak, you know. And mm-hmm. it's interesting because it's something that you find that, in a way, it really helps you later in life.
Yeah. Well, when at that point where they said to you, here's your camera, mm-hmm. go out and make a movie mm-hmm. and bring back something special, mm-hmm. how did they prepare you to do that, or did they really not?
No. There were prerequisites that you had to take. There were mm-hmm. film classes, there were beginning classes and things like that you had to take, and studying film. And you worked on everyone's film. I mean, you if you were a smart, you crewed on everyone's film, so you learned a great deal about, you know, the technical mm-hmm. aspect and just about everything about film. And the interesting thing is because UCLA didn't, they were sort of anti-Hollywood at the time. They looked at film as an art form. And we never thought of it as a way to make a living at it. It was something that, well, we didn't have any clue, you know, but I imagine it was going to be something that I did on the weekends and had a job that supported it. And so your attitude was completely different. You can only understand it in comparison to what's going on today in film schools, because there we made film after film after film. We didn't look at it as a calling card to get into Hollywood. We felt that it was our personal statement's way of telling our stories, independently of anything or anybody else. But now you find students in film school, the only thing they think about is making one particular film that's going to get them across. And they can now. When I was going to film school, Hollywood wasn't as accessible as it is now.
Mm. I have read a lot of things about your first feature, Killer Sheep, and I imagine probably like a lot of people, more people have read about this movie than have seen the movie. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to see. One of the things that I read was that you made this movie perhaps, or got interested in making this movie, because you just happened to meet someone who did indeed work in a slaughterhouse, like the character in the movie.
Well, that's part of the reason. I was interested in themes at the time, and I was interested in telling stories about my neighborhood and why, you know, there was such a high rate of attrition and why people didn't make it, you know, kids my age, you know. And so I was looking around for a story, and I had this story, and I was looking for some occupation for the main character to do that was something that was unusual, that can create nightmares and dreams and things like that, haunting sort of dreams. And I was I used to, when I was going to LACC, when my car broke down, I had to take the bus, a streetcar, to school. And I ran into this young man who was younger than I was at the time. He was a teenager. And I was a teenager, too, but he was much younger than I was. And he was working at a slaughterhouse. And he would, you know, kill the animals, but he would use a sledgehammer at the time, you know. And I couldn't imagine anyone going through that sort of experience and coming out whole, you know, especially a young man. And so when I thought of this, my thesis film and a story, I thought of, well, the character, that would be an appropriate job for him to have.
And you actually shot some of this in a slaughterhouse? It surprises me that they would let you do that.
Well, actually, I did, but in L.A., it's strange because at the time I was making the film, just before then, there was this big push by vegetarians and of another group who are anti-meat and anti-slaughter and all that sort of thing like that. Mm-hmm. And also a lot of people went to the meat houses, meat factories, and made films about them and also explored the factory and everything. And so in L.A., in Vernon, where they have these meat factories, slaughterhouses, they weren't happy about letting film people in anymore, you know. And so I had to go up to Santa Rosa, which is just north of San Francisco, to film there. And it was just a family-owned meatpacking or slaughterhouse. And the guy was very nice. And he said, well, you know, I won't charge you anything. I mean, as long as you're doing something, you know, positive and so forth and so on. And you know, trying to make something of yourself, you're welcome to use the systems, the factory, as long as you don't stop production. Mm. And so I had to drive almost 400 miles to, at least more than 400 miles to shoot those scenes in the slaughterhouse. Yeah.
The other thing about this movie that amazes me, even though this was 1977, is that I read that it was made for less than $20,000.
Oh, it was like 10 or less than that, because it was all done at UCLA, and the only cost was the film and the processing. And so everything else is free. Editing is free. And that's one of the interesting things about UCLA. Most of us stayed until they kicked us out, actually, because that was the only place you can make movies. And so, like my thesis film, the one you're talking about, Killer Sheep, that was made much earlier. And I just stayed there. And then when they said, look, you have to get out, you know, and you will give you a degree on the basis of the work you've done out of it, I said, no, I'm going to get my degree with this film. And so it was then that I finished the film and it was released. But no, it was a perfect place to be because you couldn't make films any place else.
Yeah. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 5E, filmmaker Charles Burnett. He has been honored for a lot of his work. He's got a lot of positive recognition, high critical acclaim, although a lot of his films, particularly the earlier ones, are not that easy to see. If you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, though, by the way, there's an opportunity to see two. One that he made in 1996 that was actually made for Disney called Night John, that a lot of people have said is a very fine film, and then something a little bit more recent, the film Nat Turner, A Troublesome Property. That'll be shown this afternoon on the U of I campus. Night John will be shown at the Beverly Cinema Art Theater tonight. They're both free, so if you'd like to see the movies, you can do that. And questions, comments, you're welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I also wanted you to talk a little bit about My Brother's Wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Again, here it shows you some of the, well, maybe unusual problems that directors sometimes have to deal with. The big story, I guess, that I've read about this movie is that after you started making the movie, your lead actor said, I want some more money or mm-hmm. else I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
And then you managed to come up with some more money for the guy, and then the guy just split.
Yep. Well, I mean, one of the things about independent films is that you can't make it without the help of other people and their favors. And in a way, you actually end up exploiting people in a certain way because you can't pay them really what they deserve. But anyway, I mean, but when you do a film, everyone should come to some agreement. This is what we're doing and this is conditions and so forth. And in the beginning, that's what happened. But there's certain individuals who have their own agenda, you know, and they want a little bit more. They can extort it out of you. And this one guy, he was really a fine actor, first of all, I got the money from selling the first film I did, Killer Sheep to German television and to a British television company, Channel 4, and put the money together to do this, to finance my brother's wedding. And so I had a little money. And we started the film, and as soon as I started shooting some film on this guy, enough where it was critical, he started to want to renegotiate. And I said, okay. And then I accommodated him, you know, I went along with that. And then it got worse and worse. And then at one point, my wife said, look, you should cut this guy and start all over again. But you think, wrongly so, that you can make it. You know, you can do it. You don't want to, it's, you know, you look back at where you've been and where you have to go. And you say, well, I just have to do this if you can only stick with me just a little bit more. And that didn't happen. And which was a terrible mistake, because then he held me hostage. He sort of disappeared and had to look for him. And he went back to Atlanta or someplace, and I had to get a plane ticket and all that sort of thing and send him flying back. So he steps off the plane and he tells me that he's been ordained as a preacher now, you know, and he's, I don't know, he gets off the plane with his robe almost like Dracula and a Bible and stuff like that. You know, I don't know, that's big pretense. And so it took forever because of that, you know. And there's some other problems with an editor who, you know, had some, he was, unfortunately, he was bipolar and that sort of created things. You know, you don't take your medicine, all those, you know, things happen. And so that was a serious problem. But, because of that, the film was never really completed, because I had a contract with German television that had an air date. And so, it was like having to do a rough cut and turn that in, and rather than having a polished film.
Yeah. So have you had the opportunity to try to make that to the film that you wanted? No, or actually, is not that you don't have the footage to do it?
No, I do. It's a matter of editing and cutting and trimming a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And I plan to do that and still want to do that, but people who see the film say, no, you shouldn't to touch it, you know, in spite of his, like, glowing problems with it and things like that. But, you know, some people like it. You know, I'm surprised. You know?
Probably the best-known film is To Sleep With Anger. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in that film just because of the kinds of things that you said about, because of your interest in storytelling, because of your background, mm-hmm. and also because it sounds like the Los Angeles that's depicted in that film is like the community in which you grew up. Is that right? It sort of sounds like some of the things that you've said about what it was like when you were a kid.
Well, in a way, I mean, I think the family depicted in Sleep With Anger is more of a middle class, working class family. And I didn't come in, that wasn't my family makeup at all. My father wasn't there, and my mother worked, and my grandmother, you know, helped out a great deal. And it was, we're all from the South, from Mississippi, and the community I grew up in was Southern in culture in many ways. People were from, like I said, from Alabama, Mississippi, all parts of the South. And so, even though you left the South, you were still in the South in many ways. And LA was very strange at the particular moment too, because in many ways it was racial and it was segregated, and it still is to some extent. And, one of the things that was there at the time I was growing up was this, like, extended family kind of. I mean, everybody knew you, you know, things like that, you know. And so it wasn't like, and people were more permanent. It was more of, you knew your neighbors and they were there for you. Anyway, and because of this whole Southern tradition of folklore was such an element in the community and storytelling. And I really didn't appreciate it then. And, you know, these little folk ways and things like that. Like your grandmother would have these, you know, things that she would say and do, you know, and older people, and the church was a big part of it. And as you get, like you said, like I said earlier, that you kind of not, you know, as young people, you sort of disrespect things, you know, when you don't know anything about them, you know, mm-hmm. things like that. But as you go older, things begin to change. You look back on it and you say, well, that you find that there is a lot of importance to that, and you also find that somehow or another it has become a part of you, and you use it in many ways. And then when I was looking back on it, I was looking at the community today, and I'm saying at the time I was doing the Sleep with Anger, and what's missing, and what's important in lives of people, and folklore was something I found, and this notion of tradition and an extended family, all that's been changed. And so I wanted to talk about that in a film, you know. And so I put together this little simple story about a conflict within a family, and the issue was, is there such a thing as good and evil, you know, and then how does it appear, and how does folklore and old ways play a part in today's society, and I mean, in family situations. And so that was, you know, the sort of genesis behind To Sleep with Anger.
And that film is available on video, people can see it, right?
Well, most of them are. You mentioned why Killer Sheep wasn't available earlier, or Civico, because at that particular time, I didn't have the rights to a lot of the music that I used. And now It's been shown without, strange enough, I hadn't been sued. but Miles Stone Film has picked it up, and so they had to go through, you know, securing the rights. It's taken them almost a year, so they had one more piece of music to deal with, and that's been done. And so that would be released on DVD, on video, and all that sort of thing like that. But the others, I mean, that's been a problem. And to Sleep with Anger, for some reason, well, because of the nature of the film, they didn't think it was going to make a lot of money, so they didn't promote it as such. And there's, you know, I have a lot of comments from people call and say, "Well, I can't get your film, and you can't, you know, get it in video stores. Where is it? You know?" And you know, they only made a limited amount of those films, copies of them. Same way with Glass Shield. A video rental store in San Diego was telling me there's two films that were rented constantly. One is this, The Glass Shield, and another film, Red Dawn, I think it's called. And he asked me, could I do something to try to get them to give them, you know, more copies of the film. But for some reason, I don't know, it's almost as though it's a conspiracy, you know, this conspiracy theory thing. But, you know, why, you know, you think that the film can make money, put more copies out there. It's, Hollywood is such a strange place. You know, there's no rhyme or reason sometimes to explain why they do things, you know.
Well, I know a lot of people think that it's a really good movie, and that it's a really nice performance by Danny Glover in To Sleep with Anger. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's but one of the good things about it is it has a lot of it has a shelf life that maybe people keep coming back to it, and so you know, I don't know, you think over the years the people who distribute the film would get wise to the fact that if they put more out there, they would do better.
Yeah. We're about midpoint here in the conversation with our guest, Charles Burnett. If you have questions, you can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Tonight at 7 o'clock at the Beverly Cinema Art Theater in Champaign, there'll be a showing of the film Night John, and it's free and open to the public, so if you're interested in seeing one of his movies, you can do that. This is a movie that was made for Disney, right, for television,
for their cable channel,
adapted from a novel for young adults about a man who was an escaped slave, who left and then comes back. Mm-hmm. He goes back south, putting his life at risk to teach people to read. How did you get involved in that project?
Well, David Manson had been working on a project with Bill Kane, who's a Jesuit priest, and he wrote he adapted the novel, the screenplay, and Hallmark and Disney. And, you know, as a director, you know, they interview a number of people and see who would, you know, be suited for the part and of you know, making the story. And I was called in at some point and interviewed, and they assigned me to the project. And I worked with Bill Kane, trying to get the script into a shooting script. And but I was quite surprised at Disney because the fact that they didn't want to Disneyize it in a sense, you know, make it into a Bambi kind of a, you know, or any kind of Uncle Remus kind of a, you know, image. But they were really interested in showing the horror of slavery, and which I was quite surprised. And but the other thing was really interesting and bizarre about Disney is that they have this thing called standards and practice, and we had everything in the script that we shot was there in the beginning. There was this opening scene where the young kids are hunting this rabbit, and we spent all day trying to shoot this rabbit running in a straight line and so forth. We finally got this rabbit to act right, so to speak. And so finally, and when we put the film together, Disney didn't want that scene in the film, because the next scene is that the rabbit you see is being cooked. And so we said, wait a minute, why? They said, well, because the audience, you know, and it's a little cute little rabbit running through the woods, and then the next time you see him on a spit. I said, but that was in the script. Why didn't you tell us? Because we spent all day, I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to shoot this scene, and now you don't want it in. And then the other scene was when Bill Cobb's character is going to outlaw another character, a young man who sneaks over to another plantation to see his girlfriend, is caught, and he's going to get whipped for it. And Bill Cobb's is supposed to hold the kids. He's an older slave, going to hold the young boy's hands down while he's being bitten by Bo Bridges' character. And so they didn't want the old man to hold his hands. I mean, to time. And we said, well, why? Well, it'll spoil his character for the audience. I said, but that's in the script. They said, well, he's going to spoil. And so what makes it when you shoot a film a certain way, you shoot it in terms of how you're going to edit it. And everything is very critical because you know, you have a plan, and to do that just disrupts it, sort of makes it choppy. But you're going to show Nijon getting his thumb chopped off, but you don't want the old man to hold the kid's arms. And it was those kinds, you know, of weird things that was sort of irritating. But in all, Disney did, I think, a great job of wanting to depict what slavery was about.
Well, I guess that is one of those problems that directors have to face, mm-hmm. that somebody's going to come along and say, no, you can't do it this way. Mm-hmm. Didn't you also have a kind of a bad experience with Miramax when you were doing Glass Shield?
Actually, Miramax came at the end of Glass Shield. Glass Shield was produced by a French company, CB2000, where all the money came from there. But there was one particular consultant, named Pierre Essien, who was sort of a consultant for Cannes Festival as well. He's very powerful in France. And he was upset with our selection of one of the actresses. And we had made a deal with the actor, so we couldn't go back on our word. And he was just fit to be tired. And from that moment on, he didn't want to have anything to do with the film. And he always, from that moment on, also wanted to destroy the film in many ways. He was very spoiled, to say the least. And so it was a nightmare dealing with this character. So we finally got past that hurdle. And then when the film was sold to Miramax for them to distribute it, and Harvey Weinstein, it was a very interesting guy, a very smart producer, wanted to change the film to make it more violent and sort of X-rated in language and so forth. And the film is not about that. It's not about violence as such, you know. And I said, no, I can't, you know, am I going to have guns and language and that sort of thing like that? And because of Ice Cube is in it, they wanted to promote the Ice Cube character, go back and reshoot some things and bring him out more. I said, no, it's not about that. You know, it's about a man coming of age and becoming aware of he's part of his, you know, his own downfall, you know. Thinking that he's doing the right thing by lying ends up by, you know, creating this, you know, this whole universe of problems, you know, and at the end, he becomes the victim in a certain sense, and because it was based on a true story, and so we had this big argument, and we had this test screening where, you know, he stacked a deck against me and so forth like that, and had these kids in there, and they said, well, this is not for kids necessarily, it's for a more mature audience, But filmmaking is a troublesome business, you know, and it's a very difficult business, and it's something that's really hard to explain what it is and the nature of it. It's just a bizarre business.
Yeah. Well, I was talking about this with a fellow I know who's a cinema professor here, and talking about just how complicated it is, how many people get involved from beginning to end, mm-hmm. how many things have to go right. He says, you know, nobody starts out to make a bad film, but that there were so many opportunities for people to make the wrong decision somewhere along the way that will end up taking the thing off the rails and then...
Well, I think I have to disagree with you. I think people do start off trying to make a bad film or not knowing that it's a bad film.
Okay.
I've had films where I've had scripts that said I can't believe these people look at this thing and think it's a movie. You know, it's a good story. And the impact a lot of the producers have on the thing, they don't see it as a whole. You know, I don't know how they see it. You know, but a lot of people, I guess, don't have the ability to tell stories or to be able to judge good stories, just good scripts, because a good part of the scripts you get have serious problems. And like a lot of the big budget films, you know, they're writing the script as they go, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a weird business, you know.
Well, when you say scripts have problems, is that the stories don't make sense, or they don't work logically, or that somehow they don't think about how they're going to represent it in visual terms?
All of that. Actually, all of that. The funny part about it is, ironically, is that good scripts are very difficult for people to understand. And yes, why? I mean, they figure they can sell certain kinds of material, certain kinds of script. The idea consciously, that's what they're looking for, things that are topical, you know, youthful, things that appeal to, you know, a young audience. You know, a lot of action things, you know, and I mean, these are mature people, you know, people with the college, people with the Harvard Law School, and now they try and make the transition into filmmaking, all this sort of thing like that. I had an English professor who was working on a film, and his comments, I mean, he wanted one particular thing in the film that I'm saying you can't do it because there's not enough time to develop that idea, but he wanted it there anyway. But it's, you know, it's like a sore thumb, you know, you know, it has to do with a lot of other issues that is very hard to explain in this short period on the radio. But no, people do set out thinking that it's a good film. But when you look at it critically, and those things are glowing, you know, those mistakes. You know, I was in a film where I had to argue and beg. I said, look, I'm not shooting this scene. It doesn't work. It's derogatory. It's offensive. You know, and a lot of people have different tastes.
Hmm. We're talking here this morning with filmmaker Charles Burnett. He's here visiting the campus as part of the week-long observation of King Day, and there'll be different sorts of events and people speaking and different things happening, a lot of things happening on the campus. If you're interested in finding out, you can go to the campus website, and you can see all of that. And one of the features is a film festival, and a couple of his films are going to be shown. One we have talked about, Night John, I want to mention again, that will be shown at the Beverly Cinema Art Theater. That's 910 Meyer Avenue in Champaign, sponsored by the U of I. And it's free. And he'll be there also to talk about the movie.
Yes, I will.
The other movie is the Nat Turner movie, and that will be shown at 4 o'clock this afternoon at the Florida Avenue Residence Hall, FAR, in the multipurpose room. That's also sponsored by the university. And Charles Burnett will be there to talk about that movie as well. And that's also free, so you have this opportunity to see two of his movies. You want to talk a little bit about Nat Turner, A Troublesome Property?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it is... A Troublesome Property. It was for us as collaborative group that made the film. It was Ken Greenberg, who's a head of two departments at Suffolk University. He was a scholar on it, the historian. Frank Christopher, who initiated the idea, who wanted to do a film about Nat Turner in regard to how it fits in with styrene phenomena that happened in 1970 when he released a book, The Conventions of Nat Turner. And when I had finished, Night John, which is a scene in there that talks about Nat Turner, we actually went to film school together, and he called me and said, well, I'm doing this film on that, would you be interested? And I said, sure. And so that's how we got involved. And from that moment on, we tried to get funding for it, which was very difficult. We finally ended up getting money from NEH to do the film. But just trying to do a film on Nat Turner was probably one of the most challenging things I had to do because it's so controversial. And we wanted to include the people of Southampton in the story. And that was initially what we were going to do. That was going to be a big component of it. But, you know, going to Southampton, Virginia, people are still struggling with Nat Turner. And there's a lot of tension still and a lot of, you know, that after, you know, something that happened in 1831, whatever it is, people are still having to deal with that and having to resolve these issues. And there's still family members from Nat Turner and the Francises and people who were involved in that whole slave rebellion. And we had hoped to get them on camera to talk about and to discuss what was going on. And we almost did, but, you know, it's... David Horowitz did a piece in a New Yorker, I think it was. One of the, I think it was New York. I'm not quite sure, so I wouldn't want anyone to misquote me. He had interviewed a lot of people at Southampton, and just before we were going to film there, that had revealed a lot of things that were supposed to be said off record. And so when we had built this relationship with these people, they didn't trust any people from the media at that point, and anything off the record was going to be on the record, they knew, and it created a lot of problems there in Southampton. So we had to shoot outside of Southampton, and all the sites that we were going to use that happened in Southampton, we'd hoped to use. We couldn't get permission, so we had to go to some other part of Virginia to shoot it. But just structuring this whole thing about Nat Turner, who he is, because of the, you know, except for oral history, there's very little except for, you know, the Confessions of Nat Turner by Thomas R. Gray and some articles and things like that. And so you really have to depend on a single source, basically, to get. And that's created a lot of controversy because it's like whose voice is represented there? Is there a bit of Nat Turner or is it all Thomas R. Gray? And so it starts with controversy and it ends with controversy. And so it's been a troublesome property for us as well.
Yeah, okay. I want to, maybe I should say, you know, I've been talking about the fact that both these things were free and open to the public, and I'm looking here at the screen, and it does say here for the Nat Turner show that it's free and open to residents of Florida Avenue Residence Hall. So I don't know if I was saying the right thing and saying it was open to anybody. Probably if a few folks wanted to come and see the movie. I don't think that they'd check anybody's
ID
at the door and say, okay, do you live here? Can you come in? All right. Anyway, Nat Turner, that's at FAR this afternoon at 4 o'clock. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. When the Academy Awards were handed out, and I believe this was in not 2003, but 2002, that was the year that Denzel Washington and Halle Berry won. A lot of people made a lot of that and said, finally, the contributions of African Americans to Hollywood and to American cinema are being acknowledged, and we say these two are great performers, and they do great performances, not in those, just in those films, but other films. And they say, this is the beginning of a whole new era for African Americans in American movies. Did that happen? I mean, was it too soon to say, and it's sort of saying that, well, that's a little unfair. It just was like a year ago, and suddenly we're expecting things to change.
No, I think you should expect things to change, and it should have changed long ago. I mean, there's always been a sort of cyclic kind of a thing in Hollywood where you have to keep reminding people constantly. You know, there's other people, there's a huge, diverse group of people who live in America, you know, and they're underrepresented and so forth. But it hasn't changed. And it's like, okay, now you've got it, now be quiet, that sort of thing. You know, like the television be in front and behind the camera is still predominantly white, you know, male. Nothing has really changed except that there's a lot of more in terms of black directors and producers. You can certainly find that there's a lot of, there's increase in those areas. But in terms of representation of film and quality, no, there's still only a few people. And you know, you look at the Native Americans, there's zero almost, you know, very few. It's still, I mean, there's a lot of money in Hollywood. So, I mean, people want to keep it kind of like, you know, it's job security and all sorts of reasons. But, there are actors who and directors who should have been acknowledged for their work long before that and even after that. It's still, but Hollywood is a very complicated thing in a sense that you really can't describe what it is, you know, racially and how it fits in psychologically with what's going on. It's in a world to itself, and it's a culture that keeps perpetuating itself, and all the wrongs in it as well. But hopefully with digital cinema and cameras and things like that, people can start making their own films and getting the stories out, you know. Because, I mean, you say, well, getting an Academy Award for a performance when you're not happy with that performance, you know, well, I mean the story. It's what needs to be done is people getting Academy Awards for stories that are relevant and important and helps, you know, the heal a lot of these problems we have in society.
Well, let me ask you another question. It connects with that because so many people have said there's a real lack of movies in this country that tell the experiences, say something about the experiences of African Americans, mm-hmm. a really diverse kind of community, mm-hmm. and that mostly what you get are movies that have a lot of violence and mm-hmm. a lot of crime, and mm-hmm. and people are saying, you know, why don't we have movies about average families? Why don't we have movies about middle class families or working class mm-hmm. families to really show that part of the African American experience? Mm-hmm. The thing is that when those movies, it's not like there aren't any, but mm-hmm. there aren't a lot. One thing that people point to is they say, well, when a movie like that gets made, the mass black audience doesn't go.
Mm-hmm.
As a filmmaker, that must be a little bit frustrating when people on the one hand say, why aren't there more movies like this than mm-hmm. when the movies that get made, it doesn't really seem that a lot of people, even black people, want to see them.
Well, that's not going to be true in a sense. I mean, black people do want to see good movies. The problem is how the films are promoted, one. Mm-hmm. They don't, when we did The Sleep with Anger, Goldwyn didn't have a clue as how to promote the film. You know, we gave him advice, but they didn't want to take advice from us, you know. They know how to promote certain kinds of film because it's there's a track record there and there's a model there. But they don't want to extend themselves. For black audiences and particularly adult audiences that, you know, going to the movies have been a sort of a nightmare. You know, you see things you don't want to see, you know, and you look around and say, what is there for me to see? But you have to build that audience again. You have to tap into that. In film, it's very difficult because, you know, a lot of adults work and it's very difficult where kids can do anything, you know, they have more freedom. But I think it's, again, a matter of, like women the same way. There's films that have been made particularly that women oriented and what support those films and really, you know, made it work with the fact that the women audience came out and supported them and shown that, hey, make us a film and we'll come out and support it. But I think, it's like building an audience, building, getting people back into the theater because, you know, it's football, there's all these other, the versions, you know, that are competing with mm-hmm. with film, mm-hmm. and the film is now becoming a bit costly as well. Now in certain places, like $10.50 now in places, you know, I don't think it's a problem of the nature of the film. Other thing is trying to get a good film made in Hollywood about a black community is very difficult because you have people there who don't have a clue as to the nature of what is a good black film, you know, or Hispanic or black and brown, whatever it is, people of color subjects. They want to make the same movie over and over again. And it hurts how people perceive of people of color. Because when I screened The Sleep with Anger, so people said, well, I didn't know, well, where's the drugs? You know, what do you mean, where's the drugs? Well, why'd you, you know, clean up the image of black people. I mean, what percentage of black people or people of color or anybody, you know, participate in violence and drugs? But, you know, you go to Europe, you go to all these other places, they look at it as like violent, you know? And so it's, and Hollywood has done a disservice to the image of people of color. And they fight against trying to, you know, change that image. I can tell you stories that, you know, that I've experienced, and the thing is, if you challenge that, you become marginalized even further. You get further and further outside because you're not a part of the, you know, of the conspiracy. I mean, you're not supposed to speak out. You know, you're supposed to just accept it, so to speak. And everyone knows that it exists, but you're not supposed to say anything. You're just supposed to, you know, just turn the other way. But, you know, coming up as a product of the 60s and things like that, you know, you're conditioned to sort of speak out and to, and I think that's the thing that sort of keeps you going, you know, because of the whole reason I got into film was to, you know, argue about how we're represented in film.
Aren't there some films that are out there that exist that people could at least go out and rent that you think that stand out in your mind as being particularly good films?
Oh yeah, there's a number of films. In fact, we're honoring Gordon Parks at Zornia Hurston Film Festival on the 27th, 28th in Florida in a couple of weeks, and you know he did the Learning Tree and things like that, and there's you know old films that who I'm trying to think of like Oscar Michel and Spencer Williams. I mean they're historically and they need to be looked at because of that, and there's themes certainly, but there has some, you know, they're interesting in many ways. But yeah, there's who can I think of? Oh my God, my mind sort of it escapes me at the moment. When I get back on the free, I will remember everything. But there's I'm going home. No. There are a number of works that are out there that needs to be, you know, seen.
We have a caller, and we have about 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. We'll certainly get this person in. And in Urbana, line number one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wanted to raise a question. You may have already touched on this. I'm kind of late coming into the program, but how much of America's fascination with black gangster rappers is an extension of America's romance of the gangsters, say Bonnie and Clyde and all those guys from the 30s in Chicago? I mean, I know a lot of it is racism, and I agree with a lot of what you've been saying about the depiction of blacks in the popular culture, but how much of it is also just America's fascination with the outlaw and the refusal to sort of let it go, no matter whether it's a black outlaw or a white outlaw?
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's a part of it. I think one thing, those stories are easy to tell and they're easy to sell. And there's action, and there's sort of a built-in drama that you really don't have to think about, in a sense. And they try to do what's popular, because a lot of these rappers, they have their own kind of, like, image that's associated with that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the irony of it is that if you wanted to do a story, one of the things they look for in the lead is, well, can, you know, this group of person play this character? Like we used Ice Cube and Sleep with and the Glass Shield, and it was only a small part, and we thought we'll bring the youth in with that element. However, they wanted more of the gangster, like he's supposed to be this, you know, like the images that he sings about, you know, and that sort of spoiled the relationship with the young audience, because they expected a certain kind of film, and that my film wasn't about that. But you get a lot of that where I'm trying to do a film now, and the producer said, well, can you find someone in the rap world that you know, and you say, well, that's this baggage, that's this image, but it's all about money, it's about commercial image, not about the subject, and they don't care how much harm that the product does, and how it perpetuates the image of violence, you know, and so forth. It's a weird business. I think what has to be done is that the audience has to, you know, be a part of this change. They have to write in, they have to boycott certain films or whatever, but they have to let their feelings be known in order for it to change.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll try and get real quick one more. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. One of the things that troubles me about Hollywood, for instance, is this movie Cold Mountain. It starts with the Battle of Fredericksburg.
Yeah, Cold Mountain.
Cold Mountain. Mm-hmm. And in that battle were African-American troops. Mm-hmm. They took very heavy casualties, but in Hollywood, no African-American in the whole movie.
Well, that's a very interesting movie, because you know that film was shot in Romania.
Yeah.
So there's a lump of a group of black people sort of come out of the woods in that, but that's about the only one only group that you'll see, and it's very interesting in that regard. And I think it's the fact how slavery isn't mentioned in that, in the same way with Gods and General is the one that Ted Turner made and produced, and he's in that. And you would think it's not about slavery. It's about honor, and it's about how the South was going to be tyrannized by the North. And that's I think that is more interesting than Coal Mountain. If you look at that, it's really a distortion of facts.
I must step in here because we're at the end of the time and we're going to have to finish. One more time, I want to mention that today you will have two opportunities to see films by our guest, Charles Burnett. Nat Turner at FAR, 4 o'clock this afternoon, and then Night John at the Beverly Cinema Art Theater in Champaign. That's tonight at 7 o'clock. And in both cases, Charles Burnett will be there and will say some things about the movie. So you have an opportunity to meet him and to say hello. He's here visiting the campus as part of the Martin Luther King Commemoration Week. And then, of course, you can go out to the video place and see if you can find some of his movies. We will be able to rent Killer of Sheep.
That's
so
true.
People can see that. And people should be, well, we'd cross your fingers and say at least that people should be able to see To Sleep with Anger as well. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure being here.